Just when you thought it was safe to tune into the Titans, it's back. From beyond the limits of sensibility or logic, sit back and hear, in shock, sexy wrestling promoters shaking their ass and belting out tunes. See, in terror, the immortal one and the madness take on the forces of legal real estate transactions and skin cancer. Watch, in horror, as 30 old men battle for glory, honor, and as colostomy bags burst around them, it's the Bingo Hall Battle Royal. Puke as angry washed-up losers scream and holler and act like morons, and that's just the audience. Hide the children, lock up your women, eat your pets. It's here, the unspecial
tonight's final bout is for the Intercontinental Heavyweight Championship, scheduled for one fall or to curfew.
Gathered together from the cosmic reaches of the universe, here in this great hall of justice, are the most powerful forces of good ever assembled.
The last of the Titans.
In the passion and death of their struggle, the very art that had raised them to such Olympian heights was lost. Their techniques vanished.
Referee giving instructions here to both principals, and this should be one whale of a match to wind up things here in Madison Square Garden.
All right, fans of the Titans of Wrestling, if you're digging this show, you got to know that we've been doing them for a while. We've got an archive of shows that you're going to blow your mind. Just head on over to the Place to Be Nation to check them out. Titans of Wrestling Archives, you know you want to hear it.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com. The only place to be in your pop culture world.
I haven't got the song to suit me mood. Okay. God is a concept by which we measure.
Welcome to another edition of the Titans of Wrestling,
and welcome once again to the Titans of Wrestling.
I'll say it again.
Woo-hoo.
Excellent. Yes. Welcome.
You're listening to Titans of Wrestling. Well, hello everyone, and welcome once again to the Titans of Wrestling.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another edition of Titans of Wrestling.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome to the Titans of Wrestling. It's been a while since I've said that. Getting the boys back together these days, a little bit like getting the Beatles back together, eh?
Yeah. So we all hate each other? I don't think that's true.
All right, I think it goes without saying. Pete is Ringo, of course. How you doing, Pete?
Doing great. And I've seen pictures of you, and you have a much bigger nose than I do, Barf.
I guess Kelly would have to be George Harrison. He's like, you'd have to be that. Like, am I lying?
No. What? Which one was he? Was he the quiet one, or what was his
he's
nickname?
Kind of quiet. The brilliant guitar player.
There we go. I'll take that. Sure.
So who are you, Barf? Pete Best?
I can't believe Johnny just stole my joke, because I was literally about to turn to Johnny and say that makes you Pete Best, and I'm letting McCartney roll into one. Oh,
okay. Stu Sutcliffe.
So the Titans are back. It's been, God, this must be the biggest gap we've ever had, right?
Oh yeah.
We took our summer break, basically.
Everybody,
yes, I know. I already know you threw me under the bus. It was all the fault of my play. So.
Guys and dolls.
Guys and dolls.
Everybody's been doing their solo project, of course.
Yeah. So. You're writing a book and shit.
Yeah.
Books.
Yep, well, true. And I did have time to put out a 5-part miniseries, but the less said about that, the better.
Less said about that, the better. as I put it, your Nuremberg rallies.
a lot has happened since the last show. I appear to have turned to you. And so, dear friends, you just have to carry on.
The dream is over.
And today we have not one, not two, but three special guests. I guess we could call them the three wise men, or we could call them the knights of the squared circle. Take your pick. I have no stranger to the world of podcasting, Johnny Sorrow. How are you doing, Johnny?
I'm doing good, Parv.
And Kelly Nelson, also known as Ricky. Ricky
Hello.
Jackson, right?
Ricky Jackson.
And known as Shoe on the board, we have Pete.
Hey, how's it going?
So, I thought we'd have a small get-to-know-you session here. So I can go through each of you. What is your interest in early 80s, kind of tail end, 1979, WWWF? Or WWF, as it's soon to become. I'll start with you, Johnny.
Well, for me, that's the, you know, I'm from New Jersey originally, and that was the only promotion you really could watch. It was on WOR Channel 9 on Saturday evenings, and I wasn't like a super fan in the late 70s. I was like 8-9 years old because I preferred cartoons. Right. And but on Saturday nights, if I was flipping around the channels and or near a television that was all mine, and wrestling would be on, I'd leave it on because it interested me, and there were certain characters that jumped out at me, and so I formed my initial memories, and I'd watch here and there, and it wasn't until like 83 when Jimmy Snuka came to prominence in WWF that I got, oh, that was it, you know, hardcore. But I just have memories of these guys more than like matches and stuff. So going over these now is like filling in gaps in my memory and like, oh, I kind of remember that. And, you know, oh yeah, that's why I always liked that guy. But at the same time, there's stuff I had never seen before because that was just the TV, the Allentown TV, the MSG stuff.
I have to ask you, Johnny, where did your love and fixation with Tony Garea start?
I just, you know, he was on TV. And he was a winner, and he seemed like a tough guy to me, and I just dug him. I, you know, couldn't even really explain it. He's just one of those guys, which is funny because the other guys that stood out in my memory are Albano, the Samoans, Backlund because he was the champ.
Yeah.
But it was like the more flamboyant guys, the ones that stuck out of my memory and I like. But there's something about Tony Garea. I was like, yeah, that guy's tough.
He doesn't look very flamboyant from what I've seen him in so far.
Not at all. But he came off as a tough guy to me, you know, when I was a kid. And then when, you know, he started being a jobber to the stars guy, I couldn't figure out why. You know, I'm like, well, he can beat the mass superstar. Come on.
That's probably a good time to go to you, Kelly, because you're a big mass superstar fan.
I mean, that's my avatar. I just like the old mass guys, really. So I picked that picture more than anything.
So you're from
I love you.
You're from Canada, right?
Yes, I am.
So where does your interest in this period begin?
Well, I got into wrestling 1986 due to the hype for WrestleMania 2. The Piper Mr. T fight was the first thing I remember being aware of, and I got into like all facets of wrestling really quickly. I was collecting the magazines and watching the Coliseum home videotapes within that first year, few months, and so that's where I first encountered the older matches, because there was one in particular, one of my favorite tapes ever, is the history of the tag team championship Coliseum tape, which was almost exclusively made up of like pre-1984 footage. And then there was also the history of the Intercontinental tape and the history of the world title tape too. And plus there was other older matches sprinkled around the other Coliseum tapes. So yeah, I don't know. I got into it, especially the Madison Square Garden stuff. I've always had a big affinity for it. And actually that's one of my sort of main interests when it comes to wrestling history is Madison Square Garden wrestling. So yeah, I'm really excited about being part of this group because it's literally, it's totally right up my alley.
Now, one thing that interests me, that history of the WWF tag team tape, was that, could that be subtitled, aka the greatest hits of Tony Garea? I bet he'd go over that.
Yeah, he was part of Zbyszko, Martel, was there another?
It wasn't
the whole history, because it didn't go as far back as like his team with Haystacks Calhoun, for example. Right. Dean Ho, right? No, it didn't go that far back either. It started about 78-ish, I think, from the tape.
I saw some Dean Ho detail on the board the other day, like as a coincidence. Where did that come up? Can anyone remember?
I think it was Pete that posted it.
Was that you?
Yeah, I just moved around because I'm a Steamboat Mark. And he, I just remember him talking about it on his WWE DVD and along on his shoot interview about Dean Ho, so I just thought of passing along.
So Dean Ho was like the trainer for Steamboat? Is that right?
More of a mentor.
Right.
Showed him the karate stuff and then using the Hawaiian gimmick and stuff.
So, well, Pete, why didn't you tell us about yourself?
I was born in New York, but I had moved away before I started actually following the WWF because I was born in 72. But I was actually, most of the stuff that I was keyed on is like St. Louis wrestling and the world class. And then eventually I moved to Houston, fan of, got Mid-South and then the NWA. But through tape collecting, I love actually the old 80s WWF.
Tells the fans him and Dominic were talking. Nobody cares about what you and Dominic have to say, Bruno. Just Dominic is another one of the stooges that's not going to be able to help you inside the steel cage. Along with, you know, Arnold Skoll and along with all the rest of your buddies. Along with the referee. Nobody cares about what you and Dominic have to say, Bruno. Nobody cares about what you and Dominic have to say, Bruno. Cares about what you and Dominic have to say, Bruno. Nobody cares about Dominic. Nobody cares about Dominic. Nobody cares about Dominic. Nobody cares about what you and Dominic have to say.
Looking at his record on the cage match database, he would really like a jobber's jobber. He has losses on record to Frank Williams, SD Jones, and so this was the guy that SD Jones beat, right? He's putting over Arnold Scarland as late as 1978.
I don't think Frank Williams ever beat anybody. That's great.
Yeah.
So Moose Monroe, and I mean going into this match. The note I've got is that he looks like a cross between George Steele and Boris Zukov gone wrong. Would you say that's unfair?
That's about right.
Pretty accurate.
So, what do we think of this? I mean, this is a pretty short match, but any thoughts on this, James?
Standard squash match. I could have done without any offense from Monroe. I think Tito should have gone in there and destroyed him. But Tito looked good. Nice drop kick. He looks real smooth, you know, like he'd been a 10-year veteran. I was kind of shocked when he said he'd started in 1977. I didn't know that. But Tito looked good, but he should have... I would have rather seen a stronger squash.
What did he win there? With the Flying Burrito, right?
Yeah.
Johnny, any notes on this?
Oh, yes. Yes. First of all, we got the legendary, I think it was Freddie Miller announcing. I love him.
Yeah.
I love the guy's sign in the, you know, in the he's got the guy in the audience as a sign says, Tito on the way to the top. And I'm just, you know, that takes some thought, you know, just like, you know, very, you know, understated. Moose got some chance. There was some Moose chance in the audience. There were some Moose maniacs out there, man. But the best thing about this match is Bruno on commentary completely shitting on Moose. just with just utter disdain and just, you know, Vince, well, Bruno, you know, Moose is really attacking the back. He's like, well, I don't know why he'd do that, Vince. He's never had much success with it. He's like, he's 300 pounds, but he's not a strong man by any means. That's so good. He just shits all over him. And even at the end, he just has this look of disgust on his his face. Bruno's hair looks like brown cotton candy. It's grumpy. It's fantastic. And the best, the last thing is after, you know, Tito pins him 1, 2, 3. And they're announcing the winner, and Moose raises his hand. Yeah. Like, maybe like, what? No! Oh, like he's going to get one over on him.
You know, looking through Monroe's career, I don't think he ever, like, got close to actually, like, wrestling Bruno himself. Like, I couldn't see, like, he was really putting over the job. He was literally putting over the lower mid-carder. So maybe Bruno's disdain is that this guy was that far down the card. But
his disdain was that this guy is awful and fat.
You know, like, it's a bit weird to see a jobber of that size. Like, he's quite a big man to be jobbing out, you know? Do you know what I mean? Like, he's big. He's not like a little guy.
But he's not the strongest man by any means.
Like, usually it's like the guys, the enhancement guys, the jobbers are supposed to make them people look good. I don't think Moose can make anyone look good.
I kind of feel sorry for him. Like, Bruno was burying him there, and here we are, like, 30 years later, burying him on the show. Poor Moose Monroe.
Well, at least somebody's talking.
Kelly, you want to defend your countryman here?
No. His strikes were amongst the lightest I've ever seen. But I'll take the time to say that I'm a huge... Yeah, so light. I'm a huge Tito Santana fan.
He can blaze a trail, though the rumbling...
Pablum. Pablum. Pablum.
Serious. And the blood has... Oh, it's going to be an atomic pile driver. Oh! That made Larry Sharp's pile driver look like a baby in a crib sucking Pavlov through his throat.
How eloquent you are, Cal Rubin.
What happens now is that a crew come in to assemble the cage.
Oh, yes. This was always the killer spot at a live show.
And Dick and Cal filibuster, basically, while this cage is assembled. Now, for most people...
Filibuster? That's a great pun.
Now, for most people, of course, this would be like fast-forward material. But for us...
Not for us.
This is basically where I started getting excited. Dead time...
Dick and Cal. Two mics. What's going to happen?
See, I did fast forward because I knew you guys
what?
Were getting it. I didn't need to relive it twice, so there we go.
You need to see this stuff, bro. Oh, it is amazing. It's amazing.
It's all in the eye of the beholder.
No, it's in the eyes and ears of anyone. This
you guys
is
like, you like these guys more than I do. I enjoy them, but I don't live and die by their work.
Well, so. Then you might not like Cal Rubens. Fuck the NWA. Fuck them. A rant that basically goes on, which is
you guys are gonna cover it. So I mean, you're gonna do it in a cow voice. So I mean, it's never gonna be as good.
It's never gonna be as good as this footage.
You're underselling yourself, Johnny.
No, I'm not. Okay, Parv. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, basically, Cal now says that Orton might as well go back to Chicago in the NWA.
Chicago.
Because he's not ready for the World Wrestling Federation.
You're not ready for the big time to cheat like that?
Yellow.
Fucking asshole. You're yellow, and you should go back to fucking St. Louis or Kansas City, the fucking NWA. Fuck him. That's not how we act here.
I don't know if it's now or like much later on, but he has this little rant about, but he's like, Bob Backlund, when everybody else is sleeping, is working out. Bob Orton Jr., he's smoking cigarettes.
Cigarettes, listening to jazz music, dancing around all night. Fuck him. Fuck that asshole. Cal is furious with Bob Orton over his cheating tactics because he's disappointed in Bob Orton too, because he was talking about what a great wrestler he was during that match, and then this happens, and he took advantage of Bob's integrity, and Cal is fucking fuck him, and oh, he's supposed to be what the NWA has to offer? Yeah, well, you know, the NWA can shove their own dicks up their ass, as far as I'm goddamn concerned. Fuck the NWA, and fuck Bob Orton too. It's obviously not what he was saying. It's the gist of what he was saying. It's so great. It's so great. And he doesn't stop. He goes back to it later in this too. And Cal, I mean, Dick is sort of like, kind of like, okay, we calm down. We get it.
So before we go into these interviews, did you pop for this Kelly? Because I did.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's Dick and Cal.
He turned into a dog. He's dog meat. He's not the dog meat, Dick. Fuck him.
As soon as he started going on the rant about the NWA and all that, it was like, oh my. Great. Amazing.
Also quite larger than life oriental chap.
Asian.
Yeah. Sorry, I've been listening to a lot of Gordon Solie recently, and he likes to use the word oriental. So.
Yeah, it's a safe word. Tor Kamada actually was born in Hawaii. March 9th, 1937, so he's actually Hawaiian. His name, there's no way, his real name, there's no way around it. His real name sounds really funny. It was McRonald Kamaka. Yeah, so we'll just get that.
That sounds like a drunk guy trying to tell you where he wants to eat.
Yeah, I know. McDonald's, man.
He looks like he's had his fair share of
McRonald's.
Yes. McRonald's, right?
It's like coming to America. Oh, it's McDowell's.
McDowell's.
McRonald's.
It would have been ironic if Mr. Saito's real name was McRonald's.
Oh, tough Japanese rock and chop. Window get Big Mac.
Do you know one thing I've learned about wrestling in this time period? Basically nobody was from where they said they were. Like Brow was built from Canada and he was from Delaware. You know, every Japanese guy is secretly Hawaiian, etc. Yeah.
Well, you got Ricky Steamboat, who's supposed to be Hawaiian, who's not Hawaiian, fighting a guy who's Hawaiian, pretending to be from Japan. But Ricky Steamboat eventually does become a ninja because he has slanty eyes. And,
every Native American is actually, you know, Italian or whatever.
Yeah.
Like.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, everyone in this match was from somewhere else. McRonald was into amateur wrestling in high school, and he joined the Air Force, and I know, it's hilarious.
Did you guys have that advert there, McNuggets Away, where they did the parachute? Did you remember that advert?
No.
There was an advert in the early 90s of Chicken McNuggets jumping out of a plane, and they'd land in like the barbecue sauce or whatever.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. Our American listeners, they apparently went through a time warp and landed in Torquemada's mouth, like a lot of them.
So when he was stationed in Turkey, like I said, he was in the Air Force. He trained with, quote, some of the greatest amateur wrestlers in the world. And when he returned to Hawaii, he met the promoter there, Ed Francis. And Ed Francis convinced him to turn into a professional wrestler. And he was trained by Curtis Iaquea, Mark Lewin, and Nick Bock. So three pretty good wrestlers to train a guy. He turned pro in 1959. And his name, he was named Torquemada because it's a reference to the Grand Inquisitor from the Spanish Inquisition, Thomas de Torquemada. Oh. And I did not know that. Yeah. Interesting. And his first, the first date I could find for him was in Memphis, 1959, April 20th. This was Nick Gulas at the time, the promoter. And he defeated someone named Greg Peterson. His early records are pretty spotty. He wrestled in Portland in 1962 as Dr. Moto, and he used the Dr. Moto name quite a bit. He wrestled under his real name in Hawaii in 1965. I guess that was the only place on Earth where it wouldn't have been mocked. he wrestled quite a bit in the South. Oklahoma, Florida, he wrestled in Kansas City, St. Louis. In the late 60s, in the AWA as Dr. Moto, he teamed with someone named Mitsu Arakawa. And they won the tag team titles, the AWA tag team titles, defeating Pat O'Connor and Wilbur Snyder.
Wow.
December, yeah, pretty notable team. December 2nd, 1967.
I wonder who took the pinfall there, does it say?
No, I don't know, was Connor O'Connor a big star, a big name in the AWA? I think Snyder was, but I'm not sure about O'Connor.
I'd imagine it was O'Connor.
Well, on the AWA side, there's a, you know, O'Connor as an old man versus Bockwinkel, so some recognition of that, yeah.
Yeah. Probably salt in the eyes, Finn, I'm assuming.
You know. Don't bring it up.
Let's be honest here. So that was 1967, December 2nd, 1967. And Mitsu Arakawa, actually, I've never heard of him. And we come across a lot of names, or I do, that I've never heard of. But he wrestled for 23-year career.
Wow.
You know, some of these guys, like, you dig into it, and wow, so, like, totally forgotten. Like, a total forgotten name. Anyway, that team held the titles for over a year. They had some pretty long reigns. I think I mentioned in a previous episode of in the AWA for tag team champions, holding the belts for a year wasn't unusual. So they held the belts all the way to December 28, 1968, losing to the legendary team of Dick the Bruiser and the Crusher in Chicago. From there, Kamada, you know, this is where he really... as far as being a legend in wrestling, he became a legend in Calgary. It's true, Stampede Wrestling. I'd heard the name, actually, to be honest, I always confused Toru Kamada with Professor Toro Tanaka, who wrestled around the same time. It was Mr. Fuji's tag team partner in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. But the name Toru Kamada definitely, even to this day in Calgary, or at least when I last lived there, was a name that you would bring up as someone that was notable in its history. He wrestled off and on in Calgary from 1971 to 1977 and held the North American title, which was the top belt in Stampede, three times. Now, his interactions, this is where he's really known for in Calgary, were his interactions with commentator Ed Whalen. And, you know, a lot of people, you know, don't like Ed Whalen. He's considered, you know, one of the worst commentators of all time. I won't, you know, argue and say he was great, but in the context of growing up in Calgary, it's hard to hate Ed because he was this kind of, like, grandfather-type figure or an uncle. You know, he was on TV a lot. He was the sportscaster on Channel 7 News. He did the play-by-play for the Calgary Flames for the NHL. He was a big presence in Calgary. Definitely not Lance Russell. But, you know, anyway, Ed was okay in my books. But
oh, they're in that Canada-Memphis rivalry just popped up. Right there.
That's true.
I hear it.
How does he compare to Larry Matisic?
Matisic was better. I mean, Whalen...
He would, like, butcherize, like, angles, would, like, no-sell him, or... With no silly heels, and yeah, he was pretty hideous.
You're saying he did hockey as well?
Yeah, for years. Yeah, NHL.
When there was like a fight? Was it a malfunction at the junction?
No, he had like hockey exclusive catchphrases. Take the shot was one of them. But yeah, it was weird because this was going on coinciding with Stampede Wrestling. Like, he did it at the same time. He did hockey, and it was on the same channel, Channel 7. Yeah.
I'll grant you that he was an icon, though. I'm not knocking that far.
Yeah, oh, yeah, he's a Calgary icon. You know,
yeah.
That's not as
never far, called a good announcer, though. But yeah, I'll give him iconic status.
Was he like, is he basically like a Joe Garagiola for Calgary?
Well, like, I guess as far as, doing other stuff besides wrestling. But, I mean, nowhere near as talented. He just, right. I mean, he had a lot of pull in the city, and he produced the TV. Like, he was the guy in charge of what made air, basically.
Well, he was powerful. He's
the guy to blame for all the clip matches.
Yep.
We'll never see it full.
Yep. No, he...
I mean, can you imagine, because wasn't the whole thing there... when they did the British Bulldogs feuding, he was so against it that he just no-sold it on air and killed the angle. I mean, that's a powerful announcer to be able to do.
To kill
an angle like that.
Yeah, no, and he had problems. There was another thing with Bad News Allen.
That
was pretty legendary. That ended up, like, the territory shut down, and they had to hold shows on Indian reservations after that.
Right.
It was so bad because they couldn't wrestle in their main building anymore. Anyway, yeah. So Kamada and Whalen had this, like, kind of like a Muhammad Ali, Howard Cosell type thing going with, like, comical interactions. And this is where Kamada's, like, you know, catchphrase, like, they most remembered for in Calgary, came from. And I'll try my best here. I'm not Johnny. But anyways, his catchphrase was, "No chance, Mr. Whalen."
Oh, very good.
See, is that pretty much a riff pretty much off of the other guy you get him confused with from James Bond?
Oh, I got maybe.
Yes, Mr. Bond.
Is that his catchphrase?
Yeah.
Yeah, oh, probably, yeah. Good one, Pete. Yeah, I didn't think of
that. Wow, I don't remember Oddjob talking.
I can swear it might not have been Oddjob. Maybe it was somebody else that was Asian.
Oh, let's
maybe it was Dr. No gone. You know,
I mean, I haven't seen Goldfinger in fucking like 15 years, but I was like, Oddjob talked? Really?
Maybe I'm getting confused. Maybe I'm getting confused with another Asian villain from the Bond series.
Well, they all look alike, you know.
Yeah. You know those, or maybe it's some guy playing Oriental I'm getting confused with. I don't know.
Oh, it's wrestling at this point. Like, this guy was an Irish
maybe
Catholic.
Maybe it's a Hawaiian guy, yeah.
This
maybe
Irish Catholic. This Irish Catholic with Boston played a black man.
Yeah, I'm confusing him with the Hawaiian James Bond villain. I'm okay.
Well, he was a wrestler. Oddjob was a wrestler in the 50s.
That's right.
Harry, I can't remember his name though.
Sack.
Any.
Was his finisher throw in the hat in the ring?
Yep. Yeah.
Sorry. Carry on, Kelly.
Okay. We'll get through this, and yeah, this show's gonna be epic long, you can tell. We haven't even got to the first match yet. Let's see. Okay, so in Calgary, you had an epic feud with Dan Crawford, Cowboy Dan Crawford, who was like one of the top baby faces in Stampede history, definitely the top baby face of the 70s. And they actually had a ladder match against each other in September 1972 with a big bag of money hanging from the ceiling. And Bret Hart tells the story, I believe, in his book. So I'm not sure that may have been the first ladder match. It's got to be near the first. Because I'm pretty sure.
I read Bret's book. Doesn't he say the first ladder match was Sylvester Ritter?
They had one definitely.
Doesn't Bret Hart say the first ladder match was him against Razor? Yeah. Against Razor Ramon.
And WWF.
I'm sure I read somewhere that Bret claimed credit for inventing the ladder match somewhere.
Bret invented
everything.
He brought the idea in, right?
Okay.
Yeah.
Jimmy Dynamite did it in Calgary.
Oh, yeah, and Bret Hart and Bad News Allen had a ladder match. There was tons in Calgary, actually.
Was Calgary the first promotion to use them, the ladder matches?
That's the story, yeah. I know the AWA was doing ladder matches in the 80s. I remember reading about them in the mags.
Well, didn't we watch, Johnny, who was it?
Jerry Blackwell.
Yeah, Crusher Blackwell.
Jerry Blackwell and I think Colonel DePierce.
That was a pretty good one, yeah.
And it was kind of like Jerry Blackwell's in a ladder match. I have to see this. And it was great. It was great.
But also, Kamato's in a ladder match. I mean, it would have had to be a pretty big ladder for this dude.
There's a step ladder, actually. Yeah.
Oh, so anyways, Kapata actually established roots in Calgary. He owned a restaurant there in the 70s, and he lived in Calgary, I think, up into his death, or close to it. So for as far as we're concerned with the WWF, Kamada entered New York for the first time in 1976 as Killer Torquemada, managed by Freddie Blassie, and that was Blassie's thing to manage the foreign heels. And he actually played a key role in getting Bob Backlund over on TV in 1977. They had two matches. In the first match, Kamada, of course, threw salt in Backlund's eyes, leading to a DQ finish.
Excellent.
And then the next week, in a rematch, there was a Texas Death Match, which I think was probably rare for TV to have a Texas Death Match. Kamada again threw salt in Backlund's eyes, but this time Backlund wiped the salt out with the referee's shirt, apparently, and then delivered like a big ass atomic drop on Kamada and won the match. And this was Backlund's first big TV win. That aired May 7th, 1977. So as we see Kamada here, he was basically a JTTS at this point. He left in 77, came back, and just probably not too long before this match that we watched. Basically, this stint in 1980, he was just a jobber to the stars. He did continue wrestling until 1987. And in Japan. Yeah. And in Japan, he had a huge win in 1978. He defeated Giant Baba for the Pacific Wrestling. Yeah.
Wow.
Whoa.
Yeah, no, and it gets better. For the Pacific Wrestling Federation title, which Baba had held for 5 years at that point.
Wow.
And the funny thing is, Kamada lost it 11 days later to Billy Robbins.
So he's basically, he's their Stan Stasiak.
Basically, he was, yeah.
What the hell? Yeah.
I think, I want to say this is part of the promotion where it was like the IWA or something like that. It was like weird. It was like a weird thing. I got to do a look at it a little bit more just because I remember that. It was like Billy Robinson and Baba, and it was just a whole weird situation. It was like a big, weird promotion.
In particular, there's this one woman, I don't know if you guys noticed, a young woman, probably early 20s, in the crowd who was just crazy for Strongbow. Crazy for Strongbow. Crazy for Strongbow. Crazy for Strongbow.
Double teaming some red.
I believe in miracles. Where you from? You sex a thing, you. I believe in miracles. Since you came along, you sex a thing.
Crazy for Strongbow.
Now, we are one Titan down this evening, unfortunately.
Yes.
And I would like a moment's silence because we've got one who's fallen in the line of duty here. Just before the show, James, the fifth member of our team here, he was taken ill on a stretcher, and he's gone. He's been taken by his wife to the clinic, where he's going to be treated for a serious illness.
Yeah, it's not the first time he's been to a clinic.
And
you know, the fact is, he is probably, by the time this airs on Tuesday, he'll probably be dead. So, you know, we ought to treat it as such. I've prepared a song for James. Let's see. Let's see. You wore the family name with pride. Boldly you went forward, did the things a lesser man might not have ever done. A tornado from the Missouri plains. You came and changed our lives, and now you're gone. With the Show Me State emblazoned on your battle togs, proclaiming you a native son with strength and love and pride. You're the morning star that shined for one brief moment in eternity, and all too soon God called you to his side. Heaven needed a champion. That's why he took you. Heaven needed a champion. But God knows we need you too. Oh, that's too much.
Rest in peace, James.
And it seems to me you lived your life like a candle in the wind, never fading with the sunset when the rain set in. And your footsteps will always fall here along England's greenest hills. Your candles burned out long before your legend ever will.
Well, I'm from Wichita, Kansas, born and raised, and born in 1978. And the first wrestling I can remember seeing would be 1982 or 83, and it was Central States Promotion, and I don't remember who was in the ring or anything, and I just saw it, and instantly I was hooked. It was probably Bulldog Bob Brown demolishing somebody, but it was probably Bulldog Bob Brown, 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 Bulldog Bob Brown.
James, what is this? Can you explain this to me?
This is the greatest thing ever, James. Don't fucking, don't fucking bow down.
It's always one of my favorite things to try to justify what I upload on YouTube. The reason it's on here is because it's a rare appearance by the champion on regular TV. They didn't, Bruno didn't show up on TV that often. Bob, very rarely. So Hogan. This, and then, it's kind of a special deal to have the champ on television. And plus, a lot of the times and we'll see it in the future, when Bob shows up on television, it's for an angle. So I thought this was kind of cool, to where it's like kind of a red herring type deal. The champ shows up and then nothing happens. So you see him down the road. Something to where, to throw you off from thinking that every time the champ shows up on TV, there's going to be an angle associated with it. If that makes sense.
Yes, I guess so. Pete, what was the deal here? A 10-minute exhibition match where there was no pinfalls or something?
But you can get the most pins as you wanted. It wasn't going to end until 10 minutes.
What the fuck?
There was no pinfalls. I thought the match was just to make Bob look like a stud on the mat. And I that's about all I got out of it, that Bob looked fluid on the mat, but he ends up looking like a stinker. He can't even get a pinfall on the mat El Olympico, who could have been anybody. And at least if they were going to make an angle out of it, they could at least let El Olympico turn out to be Ken Patera under the mask or something. And I don't know. That was about it. Ends up Bob looks good on the map, but then he looks like a chump because he gets no pinfall.
This is like bizarro world, because you've got Vince on commentary saying, oh, this is a really scientific match, mat work, I love this, I really quite enjoy this. What's going on here? This is just nuts.
I don't know, but it's the greatest thing I've ever seen in my life.
Can you explain why you think this is great, Johnny?
So, because it starts up, it's Bob Backers, El Olympo, whatever. And I'm going, what the hell is this? And he's signing autographs. He's popular, apparently. And then they go, well, this is going to be an exhibition. It's 10 minutes of street wrestling. There'll be no finishes. It's just an exhibition. And it got to a point where they're like saying, this is fake. And if they ever start, mad at each other, then it'll be real. And I'm thinking, Who booked this? This is unlike anything I've ever seen in my 35 years of watching wrestling. I don't remember this. I'm like, what the fuck is this? And Bruno is so amazing on commentary, completely shitting all over Olympico. See, if this was a real match, Vince, you know, Papa just beat him right away, but it's an exhibition, and now he's just toying with him. He's just toying with him. And then they go, well, apparently he's the greatest Mexican wrestler of all time. and then they go, well, over there. Maybe over there. Over there? What, Europe? Over there? Nobody says over there to reference Mexico. It's down there. Over there. I mean, was he with fucking Jimmy Cagney and Yankee Doodle Danny? Over there. Over there. Olympico is a great over there. But Bruno is coming. I was just mesmerized by Bruno shitting on him constantly throughout this entire 10 minutes. And Vince is doing everything he can not to laugh. I'm really enjoying this, Bruno. Yeah, it's a great match. And they're not. And they're just trying. And I'm thinking, well, Vince Jr. did not book this because he's shitting on it.
And he's Vince Jr. There's no fucking way. There's no Vince McMahon booking this match. Come on. There's no way in a million years.
No. And the best thing is, in the middle of the silence, and this is the greatest thing, I laughed so hard, I gagged and almost puked. In the middle of the silence, right as it starts, you just hear one guy in the crowd go, kick him in the balls!
I got that match as well. I got that.
And Bruno's like shitting on nice things. Like, look, I'm just telling the truth. There's no chance. He's the world champion. This guy has no chance. And look, and Backlund's like, you know. And then eventually, Olympico make one punch. Like, oh, I'm getting mad. And, you know, like, oh, and then they shake hands at the end. And I kept waiting for this to be anything. And it's not. It's just, it's the most amazing snapshot of weird I've ever seen in the world of professional wrestling. And then the greatest thing, where Olympico has Backlund in the head scissors, and the shot, he's just Backlund, the top of Backlund's head down, and Backlund starts shaking his head back and forth, and it's like, I'm like, okay, now to add to the awesomeness of this, Bob Backlund is giving El Olympico a blowjob in the middle of the ring, and it's just fantastic. Kick him in the ball! This should be uploaded.
Well,
they call that the joke wrestling stuff.
Wrestlecraft.
You want anything to just this entire match with the commentary? Put that out there as the most amazingly weird fucking 10 minutes of wrestling you've ever seen in your life. I love this so much.
Now you've put it that way, Johnny, I can see the funny side, but when I watched this, I wasn't seeing the funny side. And, well,
no, how you know,
I just watched, because I was just like, what? First of all, I was like, what is going on here? And you know, like, I'm an insomniac, right? I literally fell asleep about 7 minutes into this. Like, what is this? Like, are they, is Backlund living out of fantasy? Like, he wants to be in the Olympics? For some reason.
No, Backlund obviously had wanted no part of this. That was the thing about them. You know, El Olympico is doing his, you know, he's like, no one involved with this wanted this to exist. I don't know who made this happen, because Bruno shit on it, Vince is shitting on him. Olympico doesn't want to be there. Backlund is obviously like, what the fuck? And the crowd doesn't give a shit except for the guy who's kicking him in the balls.
Bizarre.
This idea was this. It's the Heaven's Gate of wrestling, and I love it. What it is.
Anyone else got any further comments here, or should we move on?
Well, yeah, I mean, you could just tell how the crowd just wasn't buying this at all. Like, as, you know, these guys were supposed to be really wrestling, and, you know, it was so phony.
On the commentary, like, well, you know, this isn't real.
Yeah.
This is fake. If they get mad, it'll become real.
It'll become pro wrestling.
What the fuck is this?
Yeah. If they get mad, it'll become fake pro wrestling.
God.
It was very weird in that way. It works on like multiple levels, but no, it's not something for repeated viewings or anything like that.
Are you kidding me? I will watch this on a nightly basis. Greatest fucking thing. I've never seen anything like it. It's fantastic.
Yeah, you hear Johnny go. Oh man, it's awesome!
Yeah. I'm gonna show my friends this. Like, you want to see the most fucked up shit ever? Look at this.
Look at him with his head in his ass.
Some of my friends who like kind of like wrestling, I'll show them like a great match or a great angle, and they'll get really into it with me. I'm like, hey, isn't this good stuff? I'm gonna show them this. And go watch this. And hopefully I'm going to have them on acid first. Because, oh my God. I this blew my mind. I've never seen anything this weird in my life in wrestling.
And look, Fuji, look at Fuji. Look like it threw salt in there.
If they throw salt in his eyes, there's no question it's gonna burn.
Look like it threw salt in there. And look at Fuji. Look like it threw salt in there.
If they throw salt in his eyes, there's no question it's gonna burn.
Right in the face with nothing but pure salt. Right in the face with nothing but pure salt. Look like it threw salt in there. And look, Fuji, look at Fuji. Look
like it throws salt in his eyes. There's no question it's got to burn.
In the face with nothing but pure salt. Look like it threw salt in there. And look at Fuji. Look like it threw salt in there.
If they throw salt in his eyes, there's no question it's got to burn.
Right in the face with nothing but pure salt. Right in the face with nothing but pure salt. Right in the face with nothing but pure salt.
Okay, well, speaking of Luthers, we're going in now to the Legends Battle Royal. And where did this take place, Kelly? It was 1987?
Yeah.
East Rutherford?
That's right.
Meadowlands,
yes. And, I'll just name some of the participants who took part in this Battle Royal. Baron Cicluna, Sailor Art Thomas, Pedro Morales,
Edward Carpentier.
Al Costello, one of the original Kangaroos.
Yep.
Gene Kanitsky. Was it Gino Brito?
Yep.
Bobo Brazil, Dominic DiNucci, The Crusher, Nick Bockwinkel, Pat O'Connor, Ray Stevens, Rene Goulet.
Fucking, come on, you can say it.
Chief J. Strongbow. And, more on him in a second. Luthers, Killer Kowalski, and Arnold Scarland in perhaps the most Titans match ever assembled.
You skipped Gurria, didn't you?
Was Gurria there?
Yeah.
When the footage starts, Gurria's making his entrance, but you don't hear him being announced.
Oh, I miss Gurria. I didn't see him. I didn't see Gurria. In fact, he's not in my notes.
Missed the pompadour hair. Wow.
Sorry, No,
How dare you, sir?
So,
all right, you probably thought Strongbow ate him.
Well, I mean, if you could think of the most Titans of Wrestling match ever, it's got to be this one, hasn't it? Like, all of our, so many of our favorites in there. So many, so many guys old and over the hill. All rolled out here for one last match in this Legends Battle Royal. Now, Kelly, do you know anything about the background of this? Like, why it took place, or...
I'm not too sure why it took place. I looked at the Meltzer's from that time, and he gives a review of it, or he talks about it after the fact, but he doesn't explain why, other than, you know, he received more phone calls than any other show in the previous, like, 4 or 5 months because of this show. It was talked about a lot with his buddies, I guess.
And what was what was the nature of that correspondence, Kelly?
I guess it was because, you know, the hardcore fans at the time would have been interested in Fez getting in the ring again, and that Bockwinkel working for the WWF would have been probably pretty interesting.
Same with the Crusher, I bet, too.
Yeah, the Crusher. Definitely.
Fez was 71 here.
71,
which is pretty amazing to get back.
Yeah, so,
the way he worked the mat with Pat O'Connor at the finish, holy shit, he was 71.
71.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. Like, it's very hard to write notes on battle royals. But why don't we? We can just say right at the top that Indian Strongbow has definitely seen better days, because fuck me, he's massive here. He looks like he's eaten Wahoo, basically. Like, he's basically, like, from the last time that we saw Strongbow, if you see Strongbow in like 83 or something, he has literally basically doubled in size. I don't know how.
Whoa. Well, that's why he ate Wahoo. That's why he was able to bill himself as the greatest Indian ever.
Well, according to Meltzer, he was 350 pounds.
My people reached.
He's also lost his hair, so he's got like the bald patch and like.
Yeah, his gimmick was he didn't wear any gimmick. There was nothing that would tell that he was Indian. He was Italian Strongbow.
Wow! So
his people finally reached the happy hunting ground, where he has been able to eat many buffalo, many Tatanka, as he will, and grow large.
So, and I have to say, he did probably get the loudest cheer of anyone.
He did.
By far.
Which sickened me to the pit of my stomach.
Well, it is a WWF crowd.
But it was, but what I'm saying is, all of those legends in there, and Strongbow's the guy who gets the pop, you know, but I guess...
The number two pop was for Kowalski. So, true. I join you with your...
And then, well, I mean, the Baron was there. Sailor Art Thomas. I mean, where the hell did they dig him up from in 1992?
Dominic got a good pop.
Dominic was looking in pretty good shape, I thought.
He looked pretty much the same as we've seen him in 1981.
Didn't miss a beat. No, it was difficult to tell what was going on here, because basically everybody kind of looked the same in this match. It's like, you know, there were certain guys, like Kowalski stood out to me a mile because he's so big, and he kind of like seemed to be stumbling around quite a lot. Did the Baron go early? I think the Baron went really early.
He did. Yeah, I think he was the third guy eliminated.
And there was a weird moment. I don't know if you noticed this. I think Strongbow was bundled out by like four or five guys, and then Dominic gave him a little wave goodbye, which I thought was pretty heelish from Dominic. Did you notice that?
They never liked each other. Dominic did. You know what? At the time, Chief J was a major, major backstage force. Dominic wasn't. Fuck you.
So that was a little moment from Danucci giving him a wave goodbye. I mean, it was different. Like, Ray Stevens was in this match. And obviously, like, Bockwinkel had, like, literally just retired or something. Like, a couple of months back. And he is doing, I would say, 90% of the work in this match. Like, he's trying his best to sell for everybody else.
He's the one the rest of the guys are calling Kid.
Yeah. Yeah. Didn't he just lose the AWA title in February, maybe January?
Yes.
I think even later than that. I want to say May.
May, so. Yeah, it was May. It was May. Yeah, it was May.
He hadn't been gone for long. He had
the draw in the December before in 86 with NA Grade.
Fair play to Bock. He worked his ass off in this match. And Stevens, and this was a little difficulty I had. Telling the difference between the Crusher and Ray Stevens during this match was that Ray Stevens or was that Crusher? Oh, he actually took a bump. It's got to be Ray Stevens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Stevens' bump outside was probably the best bump out of everybody. You know,
Stevens was a guy who was bumping around and selling in there.
Kaniski worked his ass off too in this match, though. I thought.
I don't know. There was that spot, Kelly, where Kaniski ran across the ring and missed
everybody. Yeah, it was botched. But he was at least, running around the ring and then doing stuff, you know.
Then there was the other legend who tried to do the, they knocked him over, and he tried to do the skin the cat, and he couldn't, and fell
off. Carpentier, yeah. That was sad.
And then Bobo Brazil was in this match. How old was he in 1987? I mean,
look at Bobo's knees, with the knee pads. Those things look like. Look like air mattresses waiting for him because his knees are gone. It looks like
Bobo looked like I didn't realize it was Bobo. I thought he looked like Giant Baba got a really dark tan.
he got a big pop coming out.
Yeah, Bobo got a big pop, but it was like footage of if you've seen Babe Ruth during his last. When he goes to Yankee Stadium for the last time, that was what Bobo looked like.
He was 63.
So much more thin than his prime, and it was sad.
How did he take the bump? I didn't notice Brazil get eliminated, but like that must have been pretty.
Maybe he pulled a Miz and hit outside the ring.
I mean, because that's the one.
Maybe he landed and disintegrated.
that's the thing. You book a match like this, and they all have to take the over the top rope bump. It's like,
I get my jollies this way.
Unless you're the Iron Sheik, and then
you're the Iron Sheik, in which case you can't take it.
I worked in nursing homes for 23 years, and I have to admit, I used to. Gather together all the old men every now and then and make them fucking fight, you know. So, yeah.
So basically, what happens in this match as gradually more and more people get eliminated, it seems like Thez and Kowalski, I want to say, pair off for a little bit, and then Kowalski and Konitsky seem to like do a number on Bockwinkel. They seem to like have a little alliance going on, and then. Eventually, you get to the situation where it's Bockwinkel and Stevens essentially taking on Crusher and Kowalski, with Thez kind of lurching around.
And then
basically Stevens eliminates Crusher.
Well, O'Connor was still in there.
O'Connor and Thez kind of pair off during this time.
Yeah.
Bock eliminates Kowalski. And then it's basically like O'Connor and Thez and Bockwinkel and Stevens, and then they eliminate the heels, and it's basically left with Thez versus O'Connor 101. And they, Pete, do you want to explain? They do a little bit of Greco-Roman stuff.
Oh, yeah, there. I was popping huge watching it. I was like, holy crap. Because not only were they working the mat, they were working it smooth and quickly and doing reversals and... stuff you don't see at all nowadays, and it was just heaven. It was a slice of heaven. It was great. I loved it.
Can you imagine how good Luthers was when he was 30? If he was doing stuff at 71,
I know. It's just we're gonna have to do maybe on a special to pull up some Luthers off of YouTube, and we can do the litmus test on the JDW that he was a bitch and heel at times and stuff. Versus a but man, what I saw, I was so impressed. And I know it was only like a minute and a half, but wow. And O'Connor, I've seen him do this stuff before, and he's damn smooth too on the mat. And these two guys were so good.
Johnny, any final thoughts on this
Royal? Yeah. I loved when Skulland came out and you see a guy in the crowd actively pointing at him and laughing. It's just, you know, him in his fucking giant diaper, you know, hiding his colostomy bag and just, ugh, you know. I bet you that entire ring smelt like Gold Bond powder to the point of fucking, just, ugh, dang it. Jesus Christ. I mean, how many broken hips happened in this match? Well, not Luthez, because I just got a new one. Oh, my God. Yeah, Strombo got the biggest pop, but here's the best thing. He gets to the ring, he was wearing a t-shirt to try to hide his gut, and someone tried to lift his t-shirt, and he got pissed, and they pushed the guy away. It was probably DiNucci. Yeah, fuck you.
He's too out of shape to do his Indian war dance and stuff.
I can't believe that. You know that's a rib on Vince. At this point, Chief J is like the backstage guy.
Yeah.
You know, and respected. Sorry, Parv.
Everybody thought he was a dick.
No, not everyone did think he was a dick. Not whatsoever. A lot of people really liked him.
Yeah, there's a big half and half. Like, half the guys liked him, half the guys really didn't.
Yeah, but nevertheless, here's, hey, Vince going, hey, Jay, you're going out there. Well, I don't have my headdress or hair or body. You're going out.
He definitely looked like the guy who wanted to be there the least.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Totally. Killer Kowalski got, like, His tits looked like the fucking... His saggy tits looked like the fucking chick in The Shining in the bathtub. This was awful. Carpentier, like we said, can't do this fucking skin the cat. That was fucking hilarious. I laughed. Luthez apparently has dementia because it's a battle royal and he's gonna just headlocking people left and right.
He even does it right off the bat. He's working a headlock.
Right off the fucking bat. He's like, just walking around. And no one has the guts to say. He's like your demented grandfather that you loved and respected because he's a World War II veteran. And walking around just being crazy, but you just do it. Just give in. He'll eventually put a headlock on the next guy. Just as he wanders around. And I guess the winner of this match got all the pudding they can eat. Just wonderful. And then, as I'm watching this debacle of elder abuse, which is what it was, Ray Stevens basically tries to commit suicide at his age and throws himself over the fucking top rope to the floor. I was like, holy shit. And then I kind of realized, I'm like, wait a minute. Right now it's, but right before that happened, I'm sorry, it's Bockwinkel and Stevens versus Thez and O'Connor. This is a dream match.
Yeah.
From years ago.
Yeah.
but you know, 20 years earlier, it's still a potential dream match. Or even like them at their prime versus them in their prime. That's a dream match. And yeah. They booked it that way. And suddenly I went from like, this is just, I'm embarrassed to watch this, this elder abuse. Mm-hmm. I felt like I should call the ombudsman. And so into like, well, that's cool. And then they started to wrestle. And boy, the crowd sure loved that. I know, Pete, you loved it, but the crowd was just like, oh, Jesus Christ, enough. And and then they're doing the posing thing. But here's the neat thing. Apparently, from the interviews, based on the hat that Arnold Skolin was wearing, this was all taped for George Michael's Sports Machine.
Yeah.
Which I don't know if it was local or syndicated. And no, eventually it was syndicated. That would feature wrestling. Yeah. And that's what all this. I believe that's what all this footage was like the raw tape.
Yeah, that's how we got. Film. That's how the
is that it?
Crockett Cup got circulated in '86, maybe.
Nice.
Because I've been...
Same year, I think, 87.
I was just covering with Where the Big Boys Play, Clash of the Champions 16, and Meltzer mentions that Jim Herr did an interview with that show, with that George Michael sports...
Well, it was really weird, man. It was a cool show.
He was really
tight
with Flair, I know that, too.
Well, no, it was neat because this guy did this show and he covers all real sports, but occasionally wrestling. And that was where we saw Flair win the title back from Dusty in 86. You know, they go, and now we're going, I think it was Kansas City, right?
St. Louis,
I'm sorry. He goes, and now we're going to footage. And I mean, me and Wolfman just happened to be watching, actually, the fucking George Michael, because it was a good show. And we're like, what? And we're watching this, and we see, Flair with the title back. Meltzer also reported that everyone knew what was going on during that match because they didn't light the match for television until the last 5 minutes. People came down with cameras and lights, and then lit it. Yeah. And then the whole crowd knew that right then Dusty was losing because it wasn't lit for TV until the last 5 minutes.
So Kelly, why didn't you give us your thoughts on the Battle Royal before we take a look at some of these post-match interviews?
Yeah, well, this was my holy grail, and I found it. It kind of fell into my lap just by accident.
It's the wrong cup, holy grail from India.
Oh, you fall into my lap. Did you fall? I'll fall into your lap, my boy.
I mean, how could you not love, at least on paper, this match with all the
names? Oh, yeah.
I mean, I knew, of course, it was going to be a shit show, and it was. And it didn't help that the filming of it was, you'd get half the ring, and then the other half, and then back and forth, and you'd never get the whole ring at once, really. And so it was what it was. I was hoping for the final confrontation between Baron Cicluna and Dominic DiNucci. And I believe.
Oh, God. You, Gota, you should be shot.
Why?
Hoping for that as opposed to Luther.
There's a 20-year long war between those two men.
Carrying it
fuck the NWA. Oh, fuck man. The NWA.
Oh, man.
Fez couldn't draw
shit. Stand back.
Yeah. This was the NWA invasion of the Meadowlands of 87 that no one remembers.
Actually, now that you brought it up, I'm insulted that Fez went over in this match. It should have been one of the New York guys.
Should have been Strongbow, you reckon?
Hey, speaking of guys who also were just very recently, Pedro, a year earlier, was still working as
regularly.
I think probably in 87 was still working.
Oh, I know. I used to see him. He was opening. He was an opening match guy who won.
He was still on the TV at this time, I think. Him and Tito had a tag team.
That's right.
The only guy really missing from this match, if you think about it, is Bruno, isn't it? If Bruno was in this would literally be a who's who of of all of the top stars of that previous generation.
Bruno was still headlining in 87.
Yeah. 87, Bruno was... Yeah.
Yeah, I think he'd wrestled his last match a few months prior to this.
See, headlined February. February headlined the Boston Garden with Savage.
Right.
On the network.
Yeah.
If you think I'm going into this match with all these fucking jabronis, you've got another thing coming, my friend.
It would have been cool to see him and Fez as the final two, you have to admit.
Neither one of them would have allowed the other to win.
Nope.
There's no way.
You have to wonder. It's a 19-man battle royal, so that would suggest maybe somebody no-showed. I was thinking Buddy Rogers as a possibility.
No, he couldn't possibly.
He wrestled a few years before this, and it was in the New Jersey area. I believe that's where Rogers...
Could you imagine looking at it? I mean, Grace, Luthez was impressive, but...
Oh, for sure.
Bruno at that time still looked like a fucking ape man. He was just older.
Yeah.
You know? Imagine them standing next to each other if you were going to have that ultimate showdown. You'd be like, that giant ape man Dago is going to kill that insurance salesman. It would not look good.
No. So we didn't really get the final confrontation with Baron and Dominic. I believe all we got was the Baron kicking Dominic once, and then Nothing really happened. Unfortunately, no foreign object either, which is
you know why? Because they whispered to each other, "Look, I don't like you, and you don't like me, but we both hate this fucking Strongbow." And fucking
get him out. Maybe that's what happened. Yeah, so that was what I was hoping for, and it didn't happen. So disappointing. Negative one star.
But maybe the 20th the competitor was the corpse of George Hackenschmidt when they just couldn't get it to the ring. Maybe they put him in there.
We get it hackies.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe Strongbow ate the 20th competitor.
Strongbow ate Haystacks Calhoun.
Perhaps it was billed to be Thunderbolt Patterson, but he had problems with the racial dynamics.
No, I was supposed to be in that battle royal, baby. You know, and they said that you never drew in New York, and I drew money everywhere, baby.
Looking back over my shoulder, I can see that look in your eye. I never dreamed it could be over. I never wanted to say goodbye.
God knows how this is going to go this evening, but it's totally
fantastic so far.
Just wait.
Tony Atlas versus Jose Estrada now. And
Jose,
there
you go.
Sorry, I get confused. Is he Spanish or Portuguese or was he Mexican? Jose.
He's Puerto Rican, actually.
All right. So this is the first time we've met Tony Atlas here, and the man we've entrusted to the bio this evening is the one and only Johnny. So take it away, Johnny.
Well. Dude, it's Tony Atlas. Everyone, I mean, he's managed to pop up over the generations in various incarnations in wrestling. I love the guy. His real name is Anthony White, and he was trained by Larry Sharp, who I believe also trained Bam Bam Bigelow. So he actually has two guys who were successful that he trained. Over the years, he was mainly known as Mr. USA. Tony Atlas, but he also went by the Black Superman and Saba Simba. We'll get into that.
Mm-hmm.
He started in Mid-Atlantic and wrestled in Georgia and stuff. And he had a million different tag team partners like Tommy Rich, Mr. Wrestling 2, Thunderbolt Patterson, Kevin Sullivan as a babyface. It was a big star down in Georgia.
Huge.
Yeah, I mean, they loved him. They loved him down there. And he even got along with Ole. Points. Who maybe wasn't a big fan, let's just say, of certain aspects of Tony Atlas. But the thing that he's most famous for is the tag team with Rocky Johnson. Years later after this. Where they beat the Wild Samoans for the WWF tag team titles in a no DQ match on TV. I was watching. I was a kid watching. It was one of the things that really hooked me. It was amazing. They did not like each other whatsoever at all. Rocky Johnson thought Tony Atlas was a shuckin' and jivin' Uncle Tom. And Tony thought Rocky Johnson was a glory hog. And they would come to blows backstage. When I first read this, it broke my fucking heart. And I think I read it like 2 years ago. A 41-year-old man. And I'm like, no. They were perfect. They were like gods. I mean, you know, oh, they were so cool. Apparently, he was, after they lost the belts, because they took them off and put them on Murdoch and Adonis. He was lined up to be Intercontinental Champion, but drugs got in the way, and he started no-showing, and you know, being sloppy in the ring, and he slowly went down the card as, you know, kind of a jobber to the stars for a bit. One of my favorite things of the period, though, was when Piper came into the territory, and he managed Paul Orndorff and Dr. D. David Schultz. They had a little feud with Tony Atlas, Rocky Johnson, and various other and Jimmy Snuka and whoever else wouldn't manage to be ethnic. It was a racial feud. And yeah, they pushed some boundaries that were kind of like for the North. There's one thing I wrote this down because I remember this so well. It was a promos leading up to an MSG show. It was a six man between them, and they get to the baby faces, and Atlas goes, "Papa, Orndorff, Schultz, today's my birthday, and I'm gonna give you a whooping," you know. And then they cut to the heels, and Dr. T goes, "It's your birthday, boy." Back where I'm from, we take boys like you on their birthday behind the shed and whip them with a belt.
Oh my god. Okay.
I built this with my bare hands. Dr. D. David Schultz, the greatest man who ever lived. In 87, he built that house by himself. He's online to go in the space shuttle.
Greatest man who ever lived.
Yes. He built that house by himself. Woman? Dude, I told you the TV was going to be here. What's this, a city dump? So, in 87, he goes to the dying world class, and as Black Superman, teamed with Skip Young, and he actually wore a Superman suit.
Yeah, I remember seeing the big S. Of that. Yeah.
You know, well known, he was there when, along with about 800 other wrestlers, he was there when Bruiser Brody was murdered. But the fact is, he really was there when Bruiser Brody was murdered. Found him in the shower. Carried him to the ambulance because the EMTs couldn't pick him up because he was too heavy, and was supposed to testify because he walked in and saw Invader with a knife. And instead of testifying, he got the fuck out of there because he figured if he went down there to testify, he'd be dead. A lot of people still to this day, you know, kind of like shit. I remember Mick Foley, I think, shit on him in his book about, you know, that. And I'm like, well, you know, you know, you got to look at the, yeah, he really might have not left if he went down there and testified. He hit rock bottom, as we all know from watching MTV's I Want to Be a Wrestler from a few years back. He was the ICCW champ. It was a Northeast promotion. And all that while, he was living in a crack house with the belt.
With the snowman. Yes.
Oh, yeah. And, no, and then apparently then he lost that and was living under a park bench. Now, imagine sitting on that park bench, unbeknownst to you, Mr. USA, Tony Atlas, is sleeping underneath it.
Oh, God.
And he pops up, hello, you got a cell phone? And and we all, because he got brought back to WWE's early 90s, 92, Saba Simba, and he was like a Zulu warrior. And Roddy Piper on TV on his debut goes, "Saba Simba, that's Tony Atlas."
True.
But and everyone goes, well, boy, that was like a terrible gimmick and it was kind of racist. He himself says it saved his life because he made some money on it. Yeah. He'd been like, he was about done, you know, with life at the time. Apparently he was at WCW in 1992. Did not know that. He was a WWE Hall of Fame inductee in 2006. In 1980, he was Pro Wrestling Illustrated's Most Improved Wrestler. So just imagine what he was like in 1979, you know.
Wow, yeah.
And as we all know from that MTV special, you know, he likes to hide money around his apartment because when he needs money, you know, he figures he can go looking for it later and find money. So instead of using a bank, Tony Atlas hides money around his apartment. And he was like, I hide money around my apartment because, you know, when I need it, then I forget where I hid it and I look for it and I find it. So that way I don't spend it on something I don't need. And I saved the best for actually this. I got to tell the story. I remember this story from the Observer in the 80s. That at some card, right when he was getting ready to get to, at the bottom of his WWF rope, someone went up to him and said, look, the boss is watching you tonight. You better shine. And he comes out of the dressing room all covered in baby oil and went, is that shiny enough? I swear yes. On a stack of Bibles.
That story is,
I've read that story.
That's the greatest story in wrestling history.
Is yes, that Steve, shiny enough?
Recently on a Comic-Con told that story.
Well, and then of course, to wrap things up, he's well known as being a foot fetish guy who will pay women $100 to kick him in the face as hard as they can. And in his autobiography right here, finish with this. Let's see here. Yes, the boys laugh at a lot of the books written by their peers because everybody writes about how tough they were or what great workers they were. They don't reveal their weaknesses, mishaps, stumbles, and falls. I'm not ashamed to talk about those things. I have a strong foot fetish. Actually, I'm not into bare feet. It's more of a shoe fetish, tennis shoes in particular. But feet have to be in the shoes, so I call it a foot fetish.
Right.
I'm probably the first wrestler to get this personal in their book, but I never hid my fetish. My foot fetish controlled my life. Before he died, Arnold Skolin told everybody about how I used to bring girls into the dressing room and have them walk on me. If you talk to anybody who knows me, they'll tell you about it. The wrestlers all saw me getting walked on in the dressing rooms. They used to call me a foot slave. Bill Eadie can testify to hearing Dusty Rhodes, who had a titty and butt fetish, tell me, Tony Atlas hasn't made. Wait, no, I have to do Dusty. Tony Atlas hasn't made. He will never catch AIDS from having girls walking on him. Tony can get away with things I can't, too. He can grab any girl by the foot and get away with it, but I can't grab a girl on the ass. And Tony can get his cookies anywhere. I need a hotel room. And that, my friends, is the great Mr. USA, the legend, Tony Atlas.
Thank you very much, Johnny. That was entertaining. And also,
I hope so.
Testament to the fact that you're limited to one biopic show, Johnny. But still, I very much enjoyed it.
I mean, come on. I mean, dude, I actually looked this up and was like, yeah, you're a tag team champion. We all know the cellophone joke. And I'm like, what, foot fetish?
I didn't know the foot fetish stuff.
Neither did I.
The one thing that Atlas always says on that, do you ever watch that Legends of Wrestling show? In the opening credits there, there's always a little thing of Atlas saying, the thing about my career is that it was too much too soon.
He blames nobody. He blames nobody. He says all of his downfalls are his own fault. He will not use the racism card, even though probably it was true. No. I love that he's still, even on that Legends of Wrestling show, he's keeping the gimmick alive and wearing the sleeveless suit. Yeah. That's just...
He just wrestled a couple of weeks ago in New Jersey, actually.
Was he working, Dominic DiNucci?
No. Tito Santana was on the card, too.
Of course.
Do you know, for some reason, as Johnny was going through that, I pictured like the most depressing celebrity Big Brother ever with Tony Atlas and like Virgil sitting on a bench together at some point, like talking about their past glories.
Back home, folks. And that's it, folks. It's look at it this way: we're going to be the only people ever
to talk about these matches, probably, yes, in the history of wrestling podcasting. So I look at it as
terrible. And as lead analyst, I probably won't do play-by-play on this shit.
It'll take, like, less than an hour to watch all these matches.
All right, well, join us for that, you know, stellar lineup of matches next time on Titan.
Way to go out with a bang. Trust me, we're going to make it good.
And one last thing. Best of Titans of Wrestling, Volume 1, a lean 1 hour show for all of you that have lives that are too busy to enjoy our 3-hour marathon epics.
Guys, well, thank you very much. A longer show this evening. Thanks to that epic Tony Atlas bio.
Oh, really? You called me?
just a little friendly joke.